Good evening and welcome to the final Triple Helix event of the term. This is Can We Open Source Everything? Just a couple of housekeeping things to begin with. The fire exit is at the back, or at the front, but at the back is preferable. And the toilets are just through at the front as well, so if you're coming down, just be quiet as you leave, if you can, please. And I'll move swiftly on and introduce our chair for the evening, Glyn Moody. Glyn's a technology journalist and open source blogger, and also an author of several books. In this area. So he's going to introduce the topic and the rest of the panel, and have a good evening.
Thank you very much. Yes, so after that introduction, you can probably gather it's a great pleasure for me to be here tonight because I'm talking about my favourite subject. The title is Can We Open Source Everything? So perhaps it would be useful to talk a little bit about what open source is before we hand over to the panel to explore it in greater depth. As some of you probably know, open source is also known as free software, and I think between the two of them, those two terms give you a good idea what it's about. We're talking about computer code that is freely available in both senses, that it costs nothing, and you can do what you like with it. It's open and shared. Because the source code is available, other people can do things with it and then share it with people working on it. So this idea of collaboration is very important. It's developed collaboratively across the internet. The internet's actually a very important part of open source. It's very noticeable that it really took off once the internet took off. And I think that many of the things we'll be talking about tonight will actually be intimately bound up with the internet, even though most people don't realise this is an important factor. Because you're sharing software, because it's developed collaboratively, open source is actually a meritocracy. Because people are judged on what they do. It's nothing to do with hierarchies of how long you've been doing it or who your father is. It's really what you've done in that code. And this is, again, a very important feature that's very different from other ways of working. Another factor that many people aren't really aware of, because it's a detail, but it's actually a very important detail, is that open source free software is highly modular. It actually consists of lots of bits stuck together. And that's necessary so that people can work on it in different places around the world and have their work come together and work. But again, it's very different from how people have worked in the past. Quick bit of history. It actually started a long time ago. 1984 was when free software was started, when Richard Stallman at MIT decided he wanted to write his own operating system because he didn't want to have to agree to the terms of commercial software. That was the so-called GNU project, which is a typical bit of hacker's humour, because GNU is a recursive algorithm, a recursive acronym. It's GNU's not Unix, so GNU is not GNU. The most famous part of that is Linux. Most people talk about Linux, but they actually mean just part of that GNU project. That was started by a Finn called Linus Torvalds in 1991. And that really was when it started taking off. And significantly, he put his code straight onto the internet. It was actually an FTP server at that time. And that's really when things started to happen, because within a few hours, people from all around the world were saying, hey, this is a cool idea, can I join in? And that had never really happened before. So these are some of the key dynamics. It's been rather successful. Recently, somebody has estimated how much it would cost to write a GNU Linux distribution, in other words, an operating system with the kind of software around it, from scratch today. And it would cost about £5 billion if you started from scratch. So that's £5 billion of worth that has been created. In terms of its use, it's actually much more widespread than most people realise. Can I just ask who here uses GNU Linux as a matter of interest? That's very impressive, jolly good. Who here uses Firefox browser? Yeah, okay. Anybody use Facebook here? What about Google? Okay. As you probably gathered, all of those are open source, okay? Facebook, Google use enormous quantities of open source. Those companies and their products would not exist without open source. Google has over 1 million PCs running GNU Linux. And if you think how much that would cost in terms of licensing if it had to use Windows, you can see why Google makes huge amounts of money using GNU Linux. So the whole of the so-called Web 2.0 world is really based on open source. And that really is why we're going to explore whether that incredible success, even if it's a hidden success, could be generalised to other areas. In fact, we know definitely it can, because again, I won't bother asking, but I'm sure one or two of you use Wikipedia here. And Wikipedia is a very good example of these principles of collaboration, of internet-based and modular structure. Because if you think about it, they're all little bits fitted together. And that's the perfect example of how the open source methodology can be applied to content, to knowledge. There's another very good example, perhaps less well known, which is the Human Genome Project. Because, again, that's something that actually took off once they started putting genome fragments on the internet and people started swapping information and working together collaboratively. And so the actual open source methodology has also been applied. One of the key moments was in 1994 or 1995 when there's something called the Bermuda Agreement, when they agreed to place all of their genomic information freely on the internet. And that was the equivalent moment to when Linus put his software on the internet. So those are two very good examples, I think, of how this stuff does work. So let's move on, please, and explore other areas, explore the ideas behind opening up this methodology to other areas. I'd like to introduce first Michael Robinson, who's from Deloitte & Touche. He leads the Openness and Custom Development Group there, and is an expert on open source, open standards, and collaborative working. And I think he's going to give us some very useful hands-on information on what open source and OpenSys means in practice. Thank you, Michael.
Hi, hello everybody. My name is Mike Robinson, as I said, from Deloitte. I'm a consultant, so I'm going to use slides. I'm going to talk to you today about a project we did with Transport for London on Oyster Card, and just a bit of gauging my audience before I start. Could you put your hand up in the air if you've got an Oyster Card? Yeah, so loads of people. 80% of all travel on the underground, on buses, via Oyster Card, so not a massive surprise. Right, put your hand up if you've got an Oyster Card and you're registered on the website. Disappointing. Yeah. We built it with TFL, so we did, and it runs at open source. Yeah, so it runs on a nearly entirely open source platform from top to bottom. The only part of it that's not actually is the database. But what I'm actually going to talk to you about is that actually open source doesn't overly matter to sort of today's businesses. When you go speak to a CIO or a CEO or a CTO and try and sell them this notion of using open source, he won't care. I mean, licensing is such a small part of his budget that effectively he doesn't care whether it comes from open source or not. That's just how it was developed. But there is important sort of lessons that can be learned from open source and the sort of abstract notion of what open source is all about that is important to his business. And that's that. And we kind of call it openness because we haven't come up with a better name yet. But we call it sort of openness at the moment. So I'm going to explain a little bit about sort of what is Oyster, what was the problem they were facing, what were the way they went about solving that problem, and then what the result of that was. And then the whole sort of thing behind this is this notion of openness. And I'll tie it all together with a bit of conclusion at the end. Okay, so what's Oyster? Well, most of you sort of said you've got one or you've seen one. So it's a smart card, but it's a pretty cool smart card. It lets you get around buses and underground. There's actually, this says 10 million. There's about 15 million of them in circulation at the moment. About 6 million of them actively being used. And 80% of all travel, so billions of pounds going through this thing. And, you know, 3 million a day, 3 million in the morning is going through this this thing. So our website has about 100 million a year going through it. There's lots of different channels you can interact with Oyster Card. You can ring up a call center. You can top your card up at the station, or you can actually go online on the web channel as well. Some products are on there: pay as you go, travel cards, annual bus pass, and auto top up, which is a pretty cool little feature that whenever you run low on credit, it just automatically tops it up and charges your card. You can only get that if you go on the website. See, I'm trying to push it here. I built it. Okay, so what are the benefits of it? Well, it protects your card. If you lose your card and you register online, you can just transfer it over to another card. You don't lose any of your products on there. It gets you the lowest single fare, Oyster Card, for any given day. So it'll work out what the lowest fare is, and it'll charge you that, charge you no more. You don't have to queue, because queuing sucks. And there's a big problem for TfL, actually, as well. They can't get enough space in their stations to get people to queue. So things like online and top-up stops them doing that. So it's a pretty cool thing, and you're going to see it more and more and more of it. You're going to see it going across the UK. You're going to see it embedded into phones. You're going to see you be able to buy your newspaper with it and things like that. So you're going to start seeing those things happen over the next few years as well. Okay, so what was the problem that TfL faced then? And why did they come to us about it? Well, they had a website. They had an online channel at the moment, but a little bit like the Millennium Dome, it was pretty expensive. Yeah, it was costing them a lot of money. And for that sheer amount of money, they actually weren't getting a very good service for it. So they're paying a lot of money and not getting a lot for it. They're paying a lot for hosting, they're paying a lot for licensing, they're paying a lot for services and support around that. It wasn't very flexible. Their business was growing, so more and more people are registering for auto top-up, which had come out a couple of years before, and their volumes are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and they couldn't scale their platform, so they couldn't actually scale it. But they go to the host and say, well, we need to get, can we just put another box in? They say, oh, well, if you want to put another box in, you need to buy 16 new boxes to do that, and you'd up all your licensing costs. So they just couldn't respond. And they couldn't actually respond to business change either. They couldn't introduce promotions. Like, I don't know if anybody saw the iTunes promotion they did a while ago where you got free iTunes songs when you registered for auto top up. But they couldn't actually get things like that in sort of quickly enough. The marketing comes up with the idea, and then by the time they actually get the solution implemented in the website, it kind of has gone a bit cold. Yeah. So they couldn't respond very quickly. They weren't very agile, weren't very flexible. And it wasn't secure enough. Okay, I'm not saying it wasn't secure, it just wasn't secure enough. There was a set of standards that had come in, such as the payment card industry standards after things like TK Maxx, when they had, you know, tens of millions of credit card details stolen that cost that company hundreds of millions of pounds. Yeah, so there's new standards being brought in to make sure that people's credit cards were protected. And these are pretty rigorous standards, and yeah, very hard to get a site or a particular solution certified in those standards. So, and they couldn't actually get this product, the solution they had in place, they couldn't get certified. They would have to rebuild it, rebuild their hardware, rebuild their software, rebuild the platform it sat on. So it wasn't secure enough. And Visa and MasterCard and all those sort of people at any moment could actually just turn around and say, if you don't meet that standard, you're not allowed to take credit card payments, which you can imagine for TFL would be a pretty big hit. So that was the problem. Actually, they were all just symptoms, yeah? So they were symptoms of the problem. The root cause of that problem was actually lock-in. Yeah, so they were locked into a product. They had a proprietary solution in place. And with that proprietary solution, there's only one vendor in the whole of the UK who could do hosting for them. Now, when they first bought it, there was a few people who could have done it. But at this stage now, there was only one person to do hosting for it. So they could charge whatever they want. You know, there had been a lot of investment put in this platform and this technology over the years, 4 years old. And they could charge a premium every month, every year, for their services, for their hosting, for their infrastructure. Because they knew no one else could do it. Nobody else could do this. And they knew TFL was kind of, well, if you want to move away from us, you're going to have to pay millions and millions of pounds to do it, and you're not going to reflect those savings. So we can charge you a little bit more every month. Just we work out the maximum you can afford, and just peel it back a little bit, and that's what we're going to charge you. Yeah. So they're paying a premium for that. And we see this with other products as well, like paying a premium for things. So I don't know if people have iPhones or an iPod. I know I do. But you're paying 79p a song there, when actually they know they've got you kind of locked into that channel for purchasing songs. If you bought a hi-fi at HMV, you wouldn't expect to have to buy your CDs at HMV as well. But Apple have that sort of situation, and Microsoft have it as well. I mean, I'm a big fan of Microsoft. Makes some great products, but they do use lock-in as a strategy. They do so things like using Microsoft Office and stuff. So they can make a lot of profit off that, and it's a realistic business model, and everybody does it. But that doesn't mean the business have to accept it. They can sort of, I wouldn't necessarily say the word fight back, but they do need to consider these costs when they're. When they're looking at solutions. So the actual problem here was lock-in. That's what TFL's problem is. So we needed to get rid of that lock-in. So how do we go about solving this problem then? Pardon the pun, folks, but we opened the oyster. See what it did? Oyster. All right, okay. So actually, we used a series of tools. We used open source products. We used open standards. We used collaboration. And we actually used closed source products as well. Well, I said Oracle is actually the database that sits at the bottom of Oyster. So open source solutions, like I said, they're naturally quite open, you know, but actually there's open source solutions that aren't that open, because generally, you know, you'll still get locked into that particular solution. So you still need to be thinking about things like open standards. Are there multiple services available? You know, if you're using an open source solution that only one guy in a shed ever uses or built, then you're still locked into that person, you know, unless it's actually become the sort of, you know, if actually got adoption, there actually is choices out here. This is all about trying to bring competition into play. Open standards, so they're fairly obvious. Again, it has to be open standards that are actually in use. So an open standard is a standard that's openly created, it's openly maintained, and it's open to everybody to use. Yeah. So things like the internet runs on a lot of open standards, email runs on a lot of open standards, so you know, open standards are very successful. And again, it's got to be one that's actually useful and works, you know, and people are actually using it. So things like commodity hardware is an example, so the protocols and sort of things in there, and SQL, and one example there is we're not having a proprietary data model. So actually, when we had that proprietary solution in place for TFL, an organization actually owned the data model. TFL didn't own their own data. It was kind of locked into this database that they couldn't get out of because they didn't know how to use it or what all the fields meant. And so your vendor actually owned your data. I think a phrase I've kind of used for something else, but I think works in those situations as well, as ransomware. Yeah. So in order, when your data is actually trapped in something that you don't own or you don't control and you can't actually get out to, and you've got to go through somebody else to get it back, you've got to pay your ransom to get your data back, so ransomware. And the other part of it then is collaboration. And I think this is a big part of openness. It's about saying, well, actually, let's get TFL talking to their vendors. Let's get them talking to the infrastructure provider. Let's get them talking to different people who can give them these services and these solutions. And that let's open that up. Let's allow competition in. Yeah. So there's a bit of like looking at policies and changing the way TFL would normally work or would normally think for these things. And they were pretty impressive, actually, in that side of things, working with us. And they were really willing to actually go out and talk to these organizations and work with them. So that's how we solved the problem. We used a combination of those tools. And what was the result? What did we achieve? Well, we had an improved performance. The site can handle about four times more load, or is handling about four times more load. We still haven't really pushed it to its limits. I think most of the machines are running about 20-30% utilization. The scalability and flexibility, we want to add more machines. We can just throw more machines into the infrastructure. They're all clustered. We can bring solutions in a matter of weeks. So things like the iTunes promotion, we sort of turned that around and had that going on our site in 3 weeks. And that was using a whole sort of voucher system that never existed before. So we can get those solutions in and get them released much, much, much quicker. Resilience, so the site was certified as PCI compliant, so one of the few sites of that size, the tier one merchants, to get PCI compliance for a site like that. It's very, very hard to do. So it's more secure. But actually, if you kind of forget about all those things up at the top, they're all nice to haves, and while they're all great, actually it's the one at the bottom that's the most important, and certainly the most important to businesses. There's an 80% cost saving overnight. Like, it wasn't like eventually we're going to save 80% with this thing, wait, you see what happens. It was like, right, turn that solution off. And the people that we were telling, we hadn't really told the incumbent person we were going to turn it off, because they were going to get quite angry about it. They still thought we weren't going to be able to do this. Like, and we went, right, you can turn it off now. And they're like, what? No, you can turn it off now. And switched that one on. That switch, 80% operational saving. So 80% saving in hosting and licensing overnight. For a solution that can handle four times the load and is much, much, much more secure and way, way, way flexible. More flexible and more agile. Yeah. And they can make they made that the return on investment, so they managed to get the money back from that investment within 12 months. Yeah, so they could actually recoup the cost of that project in 12 months. So that's what we did. So in conclusion, lock-in actually was at the heart of this problem. And for businesses, that's the message. That's what you take to the CIOs. That's what you take to the CTOs is lock-in or openness. Like what that when they're looking at solutions, the question they should be asking is not should I consider open source. Is the solution I'm looking at open? Is there hidden cost there that I'm not thinking about? Is there cost I'm not realizing? When I buy my iPod, am I thinking that actually, am I taking the cost of the songs over the years that I'm going to use my iPod into account and taking that as part of my entry costs? Am I thinking about my exit costs from this solution as well as my costs of getting in? So a lot of organizations see you have to pay tens of millions of pounds to move from one supplier to another supplier. Did they think about that when they bought the solution in the first place? Did they think, well, how do we minimize those exit costs as well as the entry costs? Those are things that CIOs and CTOs will talk to you about. They won't talk to you about going, well, hey, you should use Linux instead of Windows. And Windows doesn't cost me that much, so why do I care? You know, but when I actually say, well, that ripples down through your business and you're paying a lot for a lot of other things because of that, then that can really make the difference. So openness is a solution, open standards, open source, collaboration, and indeed, you know, closed source solutions out there that are also comply to open standards. They're the tools to achieving this notion of openness. And you want to think about it as early as possible. Like, you don't want to get into the position where you have to try and build it in later, because that can be expensive. It's what we have to do at Oyster. And if you are going to try and use open source and open standards, these things, you've got to make sure that the whole ecosystem's there as well. So think about what the cost of your entire ecosystem, how you're going to build that ecosystem, and how much that whole ecosystem is going to cost to support that. Not just how much is the license, you know, how much is the support. Think about everything that's involved in that. So, okay? Cheers, thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that's an excellent example of how it's not so much open source's qualities that matter, but the things that it implies to do with openness, to do with collaboration, to do with lock-in, and that it's not this kind of religious issue of whether it's open source or not, but the practical implications. Our next speaker is Tom Steinberg, who is the founder and director of My Society, which is a non-profit open source organisation that runs many of the best known democracy websites in the UK. And this is something I think is really interesting. And they include the parliamentary transparency website They Work For You and Fix My Street, But for me, the most important tool that they have created is something called Write to Them, which is writing to your MPs and MEPs. And until I discovered this site, I had never, ever written to my MP or MEP, whereas I know to do it practically every week, we're practically on first-name terms. And it is so powerful, because they respond. I just couldn't believe this. I've written to MEPs, and I get personal letters, like two-page letters back, and it may be drafted by their assistants, but they answer all of my points. This is one of the most powerful tools I've come across. I mean, I've really been able to get very, very direct feedback from these people. And I'm sure, if only because I'm occupying their minds with some of my questions, it's having some effect on their thinking. So I think this is a very interesting example of applying some of the things we've been talking about to a very interesting area. So, Tom, perhaps you'd like to...
Thank you. Now, it's particularly good to be in Cambridge giving a talk. I haven't given a talk in the university here for about 4.5 years since I set up my society. And at that time, I gave a talk to a room full of people like you who I didn't know. And over time, some of those people became our volunteers, some became staff in my society, some became friends, and one of them even connected me to my girlfriend. So I have very high expectations from this. I'm not a consultant, so I'm afraid I can't show you any PowerPoint. Sorry about that. Instead, I'll show you some things that work. And in fact, I might as well start with something which is interesting because it sort of talks about it relates to Transport for London as well. But there's a sort of sting in the tail because it's about what happens when Transport for London is not open. What you have here is you have a map of London, and the question that many, many people have who live in any sort of city, or in fact really anywhere in any country with any form of public transport system, we've done this for Cambridge as well, what people often want to know is, if I get a job in a certain place, someone offers me a job, where can I live that is an acceptable commute, that isn't too far? And what this map will show you is it will show you contour lines that describe every place that is a certain distance from work. So I just have to move this slider, and let's say it's set the slider down to 45 minutes. And what this will now show us is this is everywhere in London that is 45 minutes by public transport from the place in the middle, the red dot labeled Department of Transport that was sort of just chosen fairly arbitrarily, although they did pay for it, so I thought it'd be nice. And what you get there is you get a very interesting piece of information because London is a very complex transport system. It's not very obvious where you can live. And it tells you, for example, that you can live in Battersea in the middle there and be really, really close to work, but the transport's absolutely rubbish and the river's in the way and it's going to take you more than 45 minutes. It's blank. You can't get there. Or you can live all the way down here, absolutely miles away in New Malden, so far away that no one has ever heard of it or even ever been there. But you can still get to work in that office in 45 minutes because the lucky people in New Malden have very good transport links. And of course, the other question people often ask is, well, it's no good telling me I can live in the middle of Mayfair and get to work. Obviously, I can't afford to live in the middle of Mayfair. So we've got house prices in here, and I can slide these down to a slightly more realistic level. And then, let's be honest, if you work for the Department of Transport, I don't know if any of you aspire to do this, you're probably not going to be able to afford £500,000 for a house. Probably also not really £400,000. So you're beginning to run out. In fact, more realistically, I think you're probably going to be able to afford, as a junior person, maybe about 160, 70. In which case, little bits of Deptford are all that you really have to find. So this is an example of all sorts of things that relate to open, and this is why I've kind of picked it. The first is the code that was used to produce this is open source. If you want to go and download it from our public repository and play with it, you can. The mapping that's in the background is OpenStreetMap. This map made by people, lots of enthusiastic people with GPS devices who go out on the weekends and they record where roads are and where towns are and they upload them to OpenStreetMap and they create this map that anybody can use. It doesn't have copyright considerations. You can chop it up. It's imperfect, but it's easily good enough for all sorts of applications like this. So there's sort of two stories on the positive side. Then you've got the stories on the negative side, which is why it makes a good example. So the computer code required to make this happen and the mapping, now it's all there. What about those train times? What about the tube and the bus times, everything that is all smooshed together in here? well, that all belongs to Transport for London. You might use the Transport for London Journey Planner to get around. Transport for London Journey Planner is a beautiful thing. It works really, really well. It's kind of fairly efficient and everything. However, when you if you go and ask them, can I have that data? Can I do something else with it? Then it's not so much that you're not allowed to. It's that they don't even know how to answer that question. I've had several meetings with Transport for London saying, please can I have a database dump? That's all I want. You've obviously got this data. I want to dump on a CD, please. About half the people in this room would know the command lines to go and do that. And many of the people I talk to have no conception even what a database dump is, let alone how they do that. So I'm on four meetings and I still haven't been able to get the data. How do we make these maps then? Well, the answer is that you steal it. You write a computer program, open source code, that pretends to be an internet user who has gone to this this journey planner, and they've said, I live up there in the top left of that map. I want to know how long it takes to get to work with the Department of Transport. And you put in the query and it comes back and it says you can take these ones, and it's 45 minutes or an hour. And say, brilliant. And then you go one step along and you say, right, I now live 100 metres to the right. please tell me how long it takes. And you do that 10,000 times. And eventually you get all that data. So you can get it out, but strictly speaking, you're not necessarily allowed to have it. That's a great kind of story about the dilemma we have in openness of data in essentially government. They have lots of wonderful stuff that could help us, but either they don't know that it's valuable, they don't know to give it out, or they're actively opposed because they're attempting to make money out of it. The house price data there, they're really helpful. They will give you the data straight away. They're the opposite of TfL. They are set up, they know, they're expecting people to phone up and ask for data on how much houses cost because people across the country want to do this all the time. What's the downside? The data on this map costs £2,000 just for that little bit and those house prices. So enjoy it, because it's probably the most expensive thing you've ever looked at. So that is part of what we do. But we're slightly better known for doing things like this. This is actually our most recent website. What do they know? Now, what do they know allows people to make freedom of information requests. Now, freedom of information is a specific law that we've only had for 2 years, other countries have had for decades. But what the law basically says is you have a right to go and ask government for bits of information, and unless they've got some actually really specific reason that they tell you, they're supposed to give it to you. Before the law came in, if they just couldn't be bothered, or they didn't read your email, that was okay. You didn't have any right to request. People go to this website and they make requests through it. And what happens when they make a request through it is that the request they make gets sent through the system, as you might expect, nothing very high tech there. But at the same time, the request that they make is published online. So we capture a copy, which is here, of the request made. Dear Sir Madam, in a recent television programme, it was suggested that Tendring District Council allow the recyclable household waste to be transported to India for landfill. Does Tendring know exactly where the household collections go for recycling? So this person has asked a question. And they get a reply. In fact, they get two replies that they categorise themselves later on as saying that they got a response. I'm not going to read it all to you, but they categorised it and said, yes, this was actually an answer to my question. Yet again, there's various different sort of openness angles here. One is the fact that the team, which is a collection of paid people and volunteers, built and ran the site and do it on an open source platform. But that's almost less interesting than the fact that what's going on here is they're taking a process that was not open, formally, kind of informally speaking. It's very closed. If I can write a request to a council, I'll get a response back, but unless I own a national newspaper or I run a really successful blog or something, that request is basically secret. It's basically private. And so I might have found something that was really, really boring to me and I kind of throw it in the drawer, but it might save your life in 5 years' time. If that doesn't find its way onto the web in search engines, it's basically secret. It's basically lost. So the purpose of this is to open up that entire process. This site's been running about 6 months and I think has something around 4,000 requests, responses on it at the moment. So I'll show you then how you can build things externally. And as I said, some of this is volunteer, some of this is paid. And I'll show you some of the examples. But the question I thought I'd mull on was we're supposed to be talking about open source things, open source ideas and applications of them, not directly to code. I thought I'd look at government because other people were looking at other fields. First really naive thing to say, anything that is essentially a piece of data can be open source. That's now sort of like passed as an issue. It merely needs to be a piece of knowledge written down, and you can apply a license to it, and then it, formally speaking, is open source. That doesn't necessarily mean that people will do it, or that you can necessarily persuade people to do it. What I think is interesting about government is that they are in a position where they can accept some parts and not others. And here's what I mean. As you just saw there, that was a private sector contract working with a public sector body, and they had no trouble with using open source code. That's great. That's actually a move on from the way things would have been a few years ago, where the terror of the unknown would have been so great that it would effectively have been ruled out just because it wasn't sold by Microsoft. We run the petitions website for Number 10. Some of you might have signed petitions and got responses that disappointed you back from the government. That we wrote as a piece of open source code. Again, you can download it if you want to run a petition site. They didn't even ask. You know, they were interested in running a petition site. They weren't interested in the fact that we produced this piece of code. Yes, increasingly also, they will start that what is going on, and I think we're sort of filling a hand of history here, is they will begin to open up data. Some of it's already available and has been available for a long time. You can go to the Office of National Statistics and bore yourself to tears downloading composite indexes of multiple deprivation scores for every borough in the country. Some data has been locked up for a very long time, but my feeling is that with a lot more pushing, the direction is fairly positive. We're kind of seeing week by week, relatively at the moment, small data sets that used to be difficult to get are beginning to open up. Over time, hopefully, we'll get some of the really big ones that most people want, such as all the Ordnance Survey maps that we weren't using then because they were being too expensive. What isn't going to open up? I'm afraid that probably, although we can open up the data and we can open up things like FOI requests, the actual intricacies of policy making, despite the fact that the policies might be made using open source tools and sent to each other using open source email clients and all that sort of thing, there will always be a certain threshold at which policymakers just say, essentially, it's not all open or we can't do our jobs. Now, that's a kind of philosophical dilemma. There are people who say that's just not true. But I thought I'd set out for you where I see the progress going on at the moment. Yes, progress in the software world, although slow. Yes, progress in the data world. I think that it will require something quite different, something quite philosophical and quite something that's not really just driven by the internet to actually open up the decision-making processes, which is what many people are interested in most. So that's my little 10 minutes.
Thank you very much.
And again, I think what's really interesting about that is that we're talking about government as a store of information that we would like to get our hands on. So that's a whole new domain of data. And now Professor Peter Murray-Rust, who some of you may know since he's here at Cambridge, is going to be talking about another domain, one where you would expect information to be freely available because it's science, and isn't science about sharing data and information and knowledge? But apparently not. He's going to tell us about some of his experiences in trying to open up data in the field of chemistry and some of the tribulations along the way.
Right. Okay, well, thanks very much. I've had a wonderful introduction here, so I don't need to go over a lot of what has been said already. But I've come here actually with a slight mission, and it's spawned by the ideas that Thomas presented in asking for information. So I'm going to end up with an invitation to the audience and see what comes out. Anyway, I'm a scientist, I'm a chemist. How many of you are scientists? Right, fantastic, okay. So you probably all read a scientific paper of some sort. Maybe under duress, right, but you've read one. Did you have to pay for it? Has anyone had to pay for a scientific paper? That's interesting. Why did you have to pay for it? Right, that is a very good response, right? Okay, and why did you have to pay for it?
Because I was not a student at the time I wanted the publication.
Right. It costs you about £20 to read a scientific paper. And you don't own that paper. You rent it from the publisher. Now, I don't want to go into the area of open access here, because that's yet another example of openness and so on, and it's a complex one and so forth. But you don't realise that actually what you're doing when you're reading a paper is paying a lot of money to a publisher, right? And the publishing business, the scientific publishing business, is a lucrative one. It's grown at probably 10% a year compound interest for 20 years and so on. And it's now come to a stage where it is a major problem in terms of, you know, the finance of universities. I'm going to allude to that, but I do want you to be aware that information is sold in large amounts, and science and other academic works are part of that. Right. Now I'm going to start off with a piece of scientific data. How many of you recognise that curve? Excellent. Right. What is it? It is indeed. It's the most famous graph of the 20th century. Atmospheric carbon dioxide, which is plotted against time here. And it's an incredibly rich piece of scientific information. So the red wiggle here is the annual variation in carbon dioxide. And you can actually see the biosphere breathing here, so that, you know, the oceans and the forests are absorbing and emitting carbon dioxide over the year. And if you take that and you average it, you do a Fourier transform or some other type of approach, you can see that annual cycle there. Now, what we've done there is, Keeling did with this, is to do that average. And to do that, you have to have the data. You'll also notice little kinks here. So a little kink here in 1974. It's flattened off. That was when there was a petrol rationing, petrol price increase, and so on. And you can see that sort of information hidden. Now, would you expect to have to pay for that piece of information? And the answer is, in this case, no, because Keeling and others have dedicated this to the public domain, and that is on Wikipedia, and it is protected by the GNU public license. But that's not true of all science, and it's probably not even true of most science. So here is a true example. Last year, graduate student, any of you graduate students? Good, okay. She was working in nutrition, and she saw a graph which she disagreed with, right? It was published in the Wiley Journal, and it was about here ethanol and daiquiris and so on. Well, no interest to anybody, no doubt. She disagreed with this graph. So she put it up on her blog and said, I don't believe the data in this graph. And so what did the publishers do? They sent her a letter. Read it. So here is somebody doing what you have all been trained to do in science, which is that you are evidence-based, you collect the data, you present your case, and what's happening? The journalists say, if you publish this graph, we will sue you. So that is the problem that we face at the moment. At least half the publishers do not allow the data in their papers to be reproduced without permission. Now, that data is collected by scientists like yourselves. It's sent to the journals, and then the journals claim ownership of the data. And many of them sell it back in large amounts. So one of the largest organisations to feel that it owns data is the American Chemical Society. Now, they know my position, so I'm not giving them away any secrets here. But they have an organisation called Chemical Abstracts. Have any of you used Chemical Abstracts? SciFinder, does that mean anything to any of you? Right, okay. Well, turnover of Chemical Abstracts is probably $500 million a year. And they collect chemical information and sell it back. Now, that is fine in the 20th century. But in the 21st century, that data is in electronic form. And in my view, belongs to the human race, and if it belongs to anyone, it belongs to the organisation who created that data, including the scientists and possibly the funders. My view is that the situation is made clear if we all agree that scientific data is freely available to everybody for whatever purpose, without any restrictions whatever. And to further that, a number of groups, including the Open Knowledge Foundation and Rufus Pollock, the founder of the Open Knowledge Foundation, which meets at the Panton Arms from time to time, set this up. And this looks at a whole range of knowledge objects, but in particular, it pursues the idea of licenses. So can we have a license which allows you to do the same thing with knowledge objects as you can with software? Open source software, no real problem about licensing. Data, almost all producers of data have never thought about licensing, and if they have, they license it so that they can control its use and recover, and use it as a marketing operation. So let me show you something that a graduate student working with me, Nick Day, has done. Oh, I'm going to have to bring up Firefox for this one. It buffs on. I have to use both browsers because you never find a browser which does everything you want. It will fall over on something. So here we are. And what Nick has done is he's written a robot which goes out every night and looks at all the publishers' web pages and brings back the data on it. So it uses techniques of data mining and natural language processing and so on. So here it is. Glyn, you'll tell me when I'm running out of time, won't you?
I will.
Good. So here, for example, it's gone out and found various journals. And here's the American Chemical Society. So let's go and have a look at them. Let's go and look at the Journal of Organic Chemistry. So this is all up to date. And here, for example, it's brought back these molecules. Now, one of the reasons I'm showing you this here is that this applet, which is called JMOL, is the best molecular viewer anywhere, and it's completely open source. It's created without a penny or cent or any other currency going into it, and this is a group sort of run by gurus, rather like Doctor Who's, who regenerate from time to time. So there have been three or four gurus of JMOL, but this is a brilliant piece of thing. Anybody can have it. Nature have put it on their website. You can ask it questions. You can click on that, and it will tell you, if you can read it there, how far it is. It's not very good, is it? But it'll tell you the distance between those atoms. So it's not just a picture. It's a real living piece of software. And this over here, which is called the Chemical Development Kit, is also part of the same approach. And so as a community, we've created a group which we call the Blue Obelisk, because we met under a blue obelisk. We've got a range of open source chemistry projects, of which you're seeing two of them here. So what do I want to be able to do here? Well, what I would like to be able to do is to get all of that data from the publishers. And I've been writing to publishers and saying, can I get the data? Right? And I get five answers. I get yes, certainly. No, not on your life. No response at all. Well, we'll think about it. And the worst one of all, mumble. Mumble means, well, let's discuss it when we next meet, or something like that. And so the data that we've collected, we do not know whether the publishers will actually let us use it. We're using it anyway. I mean, I'm prepared to, exactly. One has to do these things. So what, rules get very gently broken from time to time. Now, we are in a problem because we have, we all want to abide by the rules, and the rules of copyright and so on are, I won't say they're clear, but they exist, and I'm sure many of you are actually instructed not to break copyright on academic material and so on. You're not allowed to copy academic papers and send them to people. You have to pay a license for the teaching material that you get for handouts and so on. Even though the raw data from this all came from academics who are not paid at all for it or anything like that.
Peter, if you can start the one.
I'm just going to finish in this one sentence. So what I'm looking at is, can we come up with a volunteer-based system which formally asks the publishers for that permission, and that we use tools such as Thomas Come Up, send them a letter, can we use your data? And what's more, you didn't trust the ticking clock, did you?
No.
The little clocks on that that says, have we met the deadline or not, right? Mm. So I'm looking for some form of grassroots operation where, en masse, we can ask publishers, can we use your data? Yes, give them a green page. Do they forbid it? We give them a red page, and at least the situation will be clear. Okay?
Thank you very much.
I think Peter's call to answer is actually a very important issue, that this is actually something you can do something about, okay? This isn't just abstract stuff. It's one of the lessons to draw from the whole kind of open source free software world is that, you know, everyone can do this. You can contribute. So you just need to find something you feel strong enough that you're actually going to do something about. Peter, as you can see, feels strongly about this. And all the people here, I think, feel strongly about the things that they're interested in. But it's this passion that you find in free software and open source that typically you don't find in the other ways of doing things. And so finally, our last speaker, who's Professor David Lee, who is a professor of praxis, which sounds very impressive, at Newcastle University. I'm not sure it is, but he'll tell us. And he's been very active in software development, specifically applied to drug discovery, both as a developer, manager, and entrepreneur. So I'm sure it has some interesting insights into the application of some of these ideas to the area of pharmaceuticals. Thank you.
Well, let me start with a question, and that is, given what you've heard about open source software, could you invent a drug for free? And we build an operating system, the community build an operating system. And in case you want to go off early, I'll give you the answer. It's no. You can't invent a drug for free. It costs about, current estimates, around about $1 billion per drug. And that number is rising. And it's not that $1 billion is spent on inventing that one drug. It's that for everyone that goes through to the market, there's 150 or 200 that have been worked on for 3 or 5 years, and they fail. So every one drug carries the cost of all the failures. So, there is a different question, and that is, could you invent a drug without spending any money? Because actually, Linux was developed actually by people who did, in a way, spend money. They spent their time. Somebody was paying for it. They may have been doing it part-time. They may have been doing it in their work time. But somehow they got the mortgage to pay. So that's an interesting question. And when you start to think about that, you say, well, if you can borrow ideas from open source, not just the license ideas, but some of the philosophies and ways of working, then it is just about feasible to think of a way of going from that initial bit of biological or genomic information through to a white powder in a capsule that somebody will take and will keep curing disease. It's just about possible. Nobody's doing it. It's a subject of conversation and interest, but it's not a practical solution to some of the issues we face in taking medicine forward. So, although I think about open source, I also think about drug discovery from the perspective of the long tail. And this is a term I'm sure people have heard of. It refers to businesses like Amazon and other online retailers that have a business based on the long tail of distribution. So the classic bookseller, the Waterstones, have a limited distribution channel, bricks and mortar, a certain number of shelves. They have to get so much money in to make profit, and that limits their sales to particular books that are going to sell a large amount. The long tail then, which has been opened up by Amazon and the other online retailers, is all those little niche products. And Amazon make 80% of their money from selling the hundreds and thousands of tiny little books that they've never seen in the light of day before. So the long tail is this idea of opening out the market or the activity to niche products and niche activities. And that, to me, is interesting because you can apply it in two ways to drug discovery. First of all, the long tail of disease. So pharmaceutical companies focus on the blockbuster, the big billion-dollar earner, because that's what pays back the cost of invention. Whereas the long tail of disease are those niche diseases that nobody looks at. And we're familiar with, the obvious one is tropical diseases. But actually, there are many other diseases that are niche. And in some ways, as we understand more about biology and mechanism, we are making a medicine of niche diseases, because we hone down on five mechanisms. So the long tail of diseases is all those little diseases that affect small numbers of people and never get new drugs. So to give you an example, there's Lipitor, which is a cholesterol-lowering agent, earns $15 billion a year for Pfizer. We see well for another couple of years before it goes off patent when won't get any more out of it. There was a newspaper article I read just a couple of weeks ago. I don't remember the area, but essentially the article was some people had elucidated the genetic mechanism behind a particular disease which affects 124 children in the UK every year, and of those, half of them die. And the article went on to say, well, this is fantastic because now we understand the disease, no doubt some of them can't long invent a cure. Well, they won't. You know, there's no conceivable prospect of a pharmaceutical company addressing that particular niche or long-tail disease. So we have this long-tail of diseases that are not getting addressed. And the other side of this is that as I think about long-tail and open source, our providers are actually the inventors and not the long-tail. We have the head, the big companies, and increasingly the smaller companies, but we're still talking about biotechs with 50 to 500 people. These are the companies that invent the drugs, and they're very successful at it. You know, they have been over many years. But what I think we should imagine, or could imagine, is a long tail of providers. So the people who invent the drugs are not the big companies, or even the medium-sized companies, but they're people in universities, and they're individuals with expertise. So the long tail of providers addressing the long tail of diseases, I think, are people working, exploiting the sort of open data that Peter and open software that other people have talked about, and tackling these difficult niche diseases. But the critical issue, if you go back to the long-tail argument, was the distribution cost. Why did Amazon break through? It's because they threw away the narrow distribution channels of the old bricks and mortar, and they're able to use internet to do that. When we think about drug discovery and drug development, distribution channel is the invention process. So if we look at the cost of a drug, some of the new cancer treatments are costing the NHS around £36,000 a year. Some of them cost more, but the NHS pays £36,000 per year per patient for certain cancer treatments. And of that cost, about £6,000 is the cost of the goods, so manufacturing, packaging, and sale and distribution. Now, there are many that would argue, well, why charge £36,000? Isn't that the evil capitalist pharmaceutical industry? The truth is, the £30,000 that you're paying is actually buying information. It was the information that was used to design the right compound, select the right compound from amongst the hundreds of thousands of possible during the discovery process, and the information that's generated in the laboratory by biological testing. And then, as we move into the development process, when you pick that particular compound and you develop it through clinical trials, you generate more information on the efficacy across different populations and the safety. So the £30,000 is information that you're buying. 10,000 of that is the discovery, and about 20,000 is the development part. So the argument around open source is if the information is free, or the cost can be reduced significantly, and the cost of the drug comes down to manufacturing the 6,000 rather than 36. But how feasible is it? This is not writing a piece of software. I write software very badly, but drug discovery is a huge, complicated endeavor. And it's actually very difficult to see your way through it. If I look at the drug discovery side of this, I think it's about feasible, because I can imagine online software tools, providing the same kind of sophisticated market design tools you get in a large pharma, I can see that increasingly we get access, the long tail providers get access to the sort of data and tools that the large pharma have because of the work of the groups like the lobbyists that Peter mentioned. So I've got the tools to do this design. Can I find a chemist? Because at the heart of drug discovery, there is design a molecule, get it synthesized and test it, and then learn from the data and do it again. So then I need to find a chemist somewhere in the world who will work with me to synthesize the compounds that I've designed in the computer. And then the chemist needs to find a biologist who's competent enough in that biological area to do the screening. And then we need to share the data. That is actually possible. And certainly I'm having conversations with people who are willing to do that. So you can imagine a discovery process which mimics some of the features of open source software development. It is possible to imagine the invention process taking place in this community, internet-enabled environment. But one of the things people ask me is, well, why would anybody do it? I mean, if you invent a drug, if you can do that, we'll just go invent a drug and we'll make billions. Well, you don't usually, because it takes a long time, it's very difficult, the chances of success are low, so that's not the main driver. The things that drive the open source software people is the same that we can drive the people involved in this. It is altruism, that's part of it, but it's also scratching the itch, wanting to see something done. It's reputation. It's showing that you're good at doing synthetic chemistry or biology. And increasingly, as the open source software world has shown there are business models that support that kind of activity, I think you'd see that also in drug discovery. So, as I say, it's just about feasible to think that a grassroots movement could invent drugs or get them to the point where they need to go into a human. Then you come a cropper. Then it is very difficult to see the next stage. And to be fair to pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, they've actually been very good at that first stage. They've improved their productivity. When I used to work for ICI, we worked on about 20 drug discovery projects, of which maybe two or three got into development. They're now working on 150, of which 15 get into development. They've doubled in size, but that's still been increasing productivity. But the number that have actually gone through development and come out has fallen. And there's a big drop and a big increase in expense in the development pipeline. This is the bottleneck. So why is this? Is this incompetence or is it overspending? What's the reason for this increase in development costs and the increase in failure rate? Am I doing right?
I need to be winding up soon.
Okay. Well, I'll just give this last example. Anybody watch Heroes? Series 3, Heroes, Villains, pretty interesting. Yeah, still not got my head around Silo being a hero. But Heroes and Villains, which is the most important? Well, if you think of the development process, you're a scientist, you work 10 years on a new arthritis drug to cure people or to help people with serious pain. And it's launched after those 10 years, and patients report enormous improvements. But then a study appears that shows that there's a significantly increased risk of cardiovascular disease in those patients. It doesn't mean they all die. You know, it means that 5% die without it and 8% die with it. So the papers pick that up and it hits the press. And a lawyer institutes a class action case. And hundreds of people come forward whose aged relatives have taken the drug and died of a heart attack. Somebody writes a book, and the hero is a plucky lawyer who manages to fight the pharmaceutical company, and then make a film. Tom Cruise plays the lawyer, and he gets the Nobel Prize. And so, this is for all the people who have suffered. Nothing to do with my $20 million fee for doing the film, but we have a popular culture which actually sees automatically the pharmaceutical industry or any science-based business is the villain. Is the villain the scientist that invented the drug or the lawyer that makes the money? I'm not answering. But that drives the cost of development. People are very risk averse. So in order to get through this development phase, there has to be some other cultural, political change to make development more of a community consensus activity. And this is, again, where I think we could learn from open source. This idea of a community developing a software package, a community developing a drug, and other things such as release early, release often, permanent beta. What does that translate to? Well, maybe we don't have these big 5-year development processes at the end of which somebody goes to an auditor, the FDA, and says, I've got a drug. Maybe the drug is used experimentally in the community. We gather data, and it's in permanent beta for a period. Perhaps then we'd have a different approach and a lower cost mechanism to get us to new drugs. So, I don't know if I answered the question, because I don't know the answer myself, but I think it's an interesting prospect that I'm keen to engage in.
Thank you very much.